Law is a burning thing, and it makes a fire ring. Bound by wild desire, I suited up for a trial by fire.
So
I fell into a burning
trial by
fire.
This is
Trial
by Fire by Steffi Fischer, one of our trial lawyers, winner of Rising Star, Orange County Trial Lawyer Organization, Trial Lawyer of the Year.
Burn, burn, trial by fire, trial by fire.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very, very special edition of the Justice Team Podcast from very sunny San Diego, California. We have an extremely special guest here today coming down to us from the state of Washington. Please introduce yourself, Karen. Just tell the listeners who you are, and then I'll ask you some other questions after that.
Karen Kohler.
Could you please state and spell your name for the record?
K-A-R-E-N-K-O-E-H-L-E-R.
So to my left, we have Miss Sienna Collado-Butte. Sienna, say hello.
Buenas tardes, San Diego.
Just got a big verdict last week out in San Bernardino. Tom Fair, please introduce yourself.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, listeners.
Tom is currently in a trial. He'll be closing next week. Tom, thanks for coming on as well.
Appreciate it.
He'll be our color man today, hyping it up a little bit.
Just a little.
You got some jokes?
Here and there.
Okay, so we're very excited to have Karen on the show. For people that don't know her, for our listeners, she is Washington State's Trial Lawyer of the Year. She's been president of the Washington State Trial Lawyer Organization, right?
Correct. So
she's tried some of the biggest cases we've heard or read about. We're going to talk about the duck boat one because I'm very interested to hear a little bit.
Quack, quack.
But I'm more interested about Karen, the human being, the velvet hammer, right? So I'm going to take us back to 1960.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about your folks, your mom and dad, because it's a pretty cool story.
All right. So my dad was a professor at the University of Washington. And he met my mother, who is Chinese. He was an immigrant from Germany. She was first-generation Chinese. They met in chemical engineering school.
What?
In Chicago. Yes. The rest is history.
So your mom, chemical engineer, and then a lawyer.
Yes. She drove my father nuts, being at home, having me. And he said, go back to school. She became a lawyer. And, yeah, I obviously was inspired by my mom to be a lawyer.
So your mom was practicing law in a generation where there were very few women lawyers at the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the stories I could tell you would curl your toes, but she was not your typical 5'2", 100-pound Chinese woman. She was like just a little fighter. I once saw her hit a guy in trial. He was trying to walk.
wait, figuratively or physically?
Jeez. No. He was trying to walk behind her. He kicked her suitcase, and so she didn't punch him. She shoved him, and then he.
I think the statute's
shoved
around.
Her
you
back.
Could say it's fine.
They were fighting. they were fighting in the courtroom. Yes.
Literally fighting in the courtroom.
Not physically.
And here you are fighting in the courtroom.
But not physically.
Not yet.
No.
Okay. Have you ever come close, though?
No.
Wow.
Well, the worst that I used to be a defense lawyer.
Oh, so you're not a pureblood.
And one time, no. One time, it was a wrongful death case. I was doing a whole bunch of family members of the person we killed, and the uncle called me a mother something and started chasing me around physically the desk. The lawyer had stepped out. I had to run upstairs. He was chasing me, yeah. So I guess there's some physicality involved.
Wow. Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
So did your, how did your folks empower you, or when did you know, and I read your bio, so I know the answer to this.
Okay.
When did you know you wanted to become a trial lawyer for the people?
Eighth grade.
Tell us the story. Come on, there's got to be something.
I don't even know what happened, but I was always really interested in fighting for the little guy and standing up for your rights. My parents both believed, you know, in don't discriminate, treat everyone fairly. I'm a mixed race person. I don't really see race the same way as a lot of people I think do. That was my norm, the family with different, totally different cultures, but that was our culture. It was a diverse culture. And just not liking seeing punks go around beating up people.
Nice.
Yeah.
And I think everybody, I mean, Sienna and Tom have similar backgrounds. First generation, Tom.
Yeah, my parents sort of enlisted in me those same things. My father immigrated here from Hungary. My mom, escaped a dictator in Romania and a lot of persecution that both of them experienced in their families. And so this was, for them, coming to America was a dream come true. And I've always had that sense of fighting for the little guy, and that sense of indignity when you see somebody being taken advantage of, especially if they're vulnerable and somebody else is doing that. So yeah. I think that's what's driven me to do this too.
And how about you, Sienna? Similar.
Same thing. I think I've talked about it before. My parents are from Panama. They both came here for better opportunities, and they delivered newspapers for a living. So they sold me to the hard work and dedications, everything. Be humble. Don't forget where you came from. And I've always stood up to the little guy as well, playground or streets or courtroom.
Wow. So,
and yet, I represented the big bad guys for a while.
The insurance company?
I know. And
it's like I lost my mind, but my mom had a chaotic practice. I used to work for her, and I was like, I'm never going to be like my mom. And I want to be an appellate lawyer working for a big corporation.
Well, that took a 180.
I did. And then I did my first project was to write an appeals brief in a labor contract dispute. And then they had a shortage in litigation.
Oh, sorry, I fell asleep for a second.
They had a shortage in litigation. They threw me in litigation where I didn't want to be, but I never left litigation.
Wow.
But I did change back to the plaintiff side.
Good. So when you go into church and dip your hand in the holy water, does it sizzle a little bit or steam from the back in the day?
Being a defense lawyer is probably one of the best things.
That's
I ever
what
did.
We have a lot of defense lawyers that work at our firm say the same thing. Great insight.
The key is not to be a defense lawyer for too long, because you'll be jaded and you never can return.
Everybody's a malingerer and a faker and
there's
a liar.
There's a point of no return, right?
But that's a benefit for us in trial when they go that way, right?
That's right.
Absolutely.
So, Karen, I want to ask you, a lot of our listeners heard about your $123 million verdict last year, year before. When did that one come down?
February.
Wow. And that was, I want to hear more about it, because all I know, it took 4 or 5 months to try that case.
Right.
How many people did you represent in that case?
So, in the case, I represented about 48, but in trial, we brought in 43. And that's because some of people heard about us too late, so they joined too late, and the defense objected, so I had to resolve their case later.
Okay.
So we went to trial with 43 people, individuals, and we were bound and determined not to be a class action, not to be, not to do bellwether, which is where you pick two or three cases and try them and then spread an algorithm. We wanted everyone to be treated as an individual.
So explain that for our listeners, the difference between a class and then trying them individually, and what your strategy was.
Yeah, so almost never in a mass disaster do you get an individual trial for each person that's injured. Normally, there's some kind of a process, right? Maybe you have a trial for liability, and if you win liability, then they go through an administrative process of figuring out damages. Or you go bellwether, which is you try two or three sample cases, and then you use those to create the algorithm for the other cases, like a death case or a severe injury case and then a more minor case without the physical injury. We didn't want to do that, and we wanted to have a trial with the individual claims unbifurcated, so the liability was with the damages.
Wow. And when you tried the case, there were multiple defendants.
Four.
All right. So just educate our listeners on why there were four defendants and your theories against them.
Right. So there were the Ride the Ducks Seattle, which was a touring company that was responsible for maintaining the amphibious vehicle. Ride the Ducks International, which was the manufacturer and also responsible for keeping the vehicles updated in terms of how they were functioning as a product manufacturer. We also sued the state and the city for the Aurora Bridge where this happened, for a lack of a median barrier, and it's a crappy old bridge where it happened.
So tell our listeners, how did this shake out in trial? First, just by percentages of liability on...
Right. So the percentages turned out to be 70% against the manufacturer.
Wow.
30% against Ride the Ducks Seattle, the operator, and they let the city and the state go. They told us that was the one issue they really kind of struggled with, and we knew this.
Yeah.
But the negligence was so bad of the ducks that they didn't feel that even if the bridge was bad, that it really caused anything. And it was actually completely fine with us because we knew that there was enough insurance money to cover the verdict. We hit a sweet spot. Barely. There was $10 million left on that policy when we were done.
Oof.
And someone just came and like gave us a bad...
Yeah, if you're watching on YouTube, Rob Gibson, who I've tried a very monumental case together, just he came and gave me a very distinguished hand gesture.
Yes, he did.
It was a hello.
Hello, kitty.
Hello. Anyway, so they said that was they went back and forth on that one, but ultimately said, no, we'll let them out. That was fine.
And do you think it was because of the more egregious actions?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
And not just, oh, it's a government entity that slapped them on
the wrist. No, but I would never do it a different way because the attorney for the state was quite good.
It was your best friend in trial.
He was. Mm. So, like, I would do my stuff. Then the duck defendants would come in, quack a little bit. And then he would come in and just punch him again. Like, punch him.
Nice.
So it was awesome.
And when you tried the case, liability was not bifurcated. So
we did something very unusual. And we did this because we had a trial consultant, Artemis Malakour.
She just walked by earlier.
Yeah, she's awesome. And we talked about, normally you would do the kind of the liability and then go into the human story because you don't want to always start with the human story first because that could backfire, right? So we wanted to start with liability. The problem would be on a very long trial, which we thought would be about 5 months. It turned out to be 4 months. The problem was that if you do liability first, let's say it takes a month and the jury's really angry.
Yeah. You lose that.
Then 3 months later, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, they're going to just be wiped out.
So what did you do to tick the jury off in the beginning and then at the end?
So what we did was, well, the jury was ticked off. That's true. But they became more ticked off because we kind of let little bits and pieces come out later. Like they didn't know how bad it was until in the trial. We kept their interest. I really believe in building mystery and excitement. And
yeah, so let me ask you that. When you go in a case like this and you know it's going to be multiple months, when you're doing your opening argument, we'll call it argument because that's what I do, when you do your opening statement, do you show all of those cards or do you leave, are you a mystery?
So I'm a mystery and I also don't argue opening ever, supposedly. I don't act like I'm arguing opening. I don't want to because they don't know me and juries don't like to be preached at. Mm-hmm. I'm a very relationship building person. So it's like, you trust me, I'm going to tell you some stuff. There's going to be more. And
Where did you get your gravitas? Where did you get your comfortability in front of a jury to be where you are today?
So my gravitas is so great that I put on a captain's hat, wore a duck whistle, and
blew. No.
Oh, yeah. I clapped. My first words to the jury were, we are going on a journey. My name is Captain Quacky Pants or whatever my name was. I was wearing a hat and a whistle, and we took him on a journey. I'm going to say it. I'm going to tell you stuff that, you know, that I know, and I'm not going to tell you the stuff I don't know. And here's all the stuff I don't know. And it was all the bad stuff, right, or some of it. So I'm comfortable. I'm into relationship building and having a connection, and I want you to trust me and know that I'm not going to lead you down the wrong path versus a defense who's going to come in and preach at them and make themselves look fantastic, and then they're going to fall on their butts.
Credibility. So how did you... Your nickname is the Velvet Hammer, which is awesome.
Thank you.
I think it's pretty sweet.
That is a sweet nickname.
Thank you. Trademarked.
Tom,
trademarked.
Really? Well played.
Of course I trademarked.
Well, we call Tom, he's like the hollow vanilla hammer, like the one you get at Easter. You're always disappointed. It's not really. how did you get that nickname?
So a defense lawyer friend of mine, quite prominent, told me that the defense bar was calling me the Velvet Hammer because I would smile at them while I was patting him into the ground.
That's a very nice thing of them to say.
It was.
You know, kill with kindness.
I thought it was funny, and I just said, I just thought, that's funny. I'm going to use that.
Well, did somebody tell you that you are now the Velvet Hammer? I mean, how did you come to learn that was your name?
That's what they were calling. The defense lawyers were calling me that. I was the Velvet Hammer.
The things the defense lawyers call me, I can't really say on radio, nor trademark. Well, no, certainly not. Yeah, but I mean, if anybody's been to your website, educate the listeners on your website, because it's not like a traditional lawyer website. It's awesome. Like, get some cool
multiple choice questions. Yeah.
It's like multiple like cool stories about you and your family or your three daughters. Well, let me ask you this. You've had, I mean, you started full time being a lawyer when your youngest was started kindergarten, 5 years old.
And I mean, coming out of law school, my then husband was a professional basketball player in Europe. So I told my first job that I can't work full time. I'll work full time when I'm here. And then when I have to go overseas, we worked out that arrangement. And then when I had children, I kept that arrangement going. So it's always kind of my own kind of hours. I tried with cases back then. Mm-hmm. I just would be there for those. But so I had that kind of part-time, which at the time was kind of a second-class citizen, especially in a large law firm. There were 50 lawyers in the defense firm and kind of second-class citizen. Like, she's not on the partnership track because I wasn't.
But did you want to be?
It didn't really hold me back. you know, it's a long ride. The beauty of our career is that we can do this for a very long time. And to kind of
we're like the professional golfers of the sports world. You play
to kind of stuff everything in at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to do that, and you don't really have to do that. It's good to become a human being first and not lose who you are as a person. I think that's one of my strengths, is because I spent so much time with my family and taking care of my kids. Like, I'm a good storyteller because I can act it all out, right? I put them to bed and I acted it out, and that's what's important, are the family human values that we have as lawyers.
And do you find that you're more easily able to connect with juries when you're telling stories that are real or resonate with you? And I was speaking from, like, I have a 2-year-old, Sienna has a 3-year-old, he has a 3-month-old, 4-month-old.
11 weeks. I have a grandchild. You guys are like so young.
Wow.
Man, I'm old. I'm just slumping down in my chair.
Well, we started much later in life, I guess.
No, but I think you're saying is really important for anybody that ever wants to be a trial lawyer or a decent human being. It is about relationships. Whether you're marketing, whether your business is, you know, pre-lit or lit, or whether you're a trial lawyer, if you don't build those relationships with those jurors, they're not going to be rooting for you or for your client. And I think you have a duty to build that relationship, especially in a 4-month case. Yeah. It's every day, every week, you're slowly weaving those threads.
And you got to be comfortable who you are, right? Mm-hmm. And for your story. And I think after I became a dad, it makes it easier to understand what our clients go through and talk about those milestones we go through closing, the things they have to look forward to. But credibility is never given, it's earned. And it sounds like you earned a ton of credibility.
You know, I used to tell people, you don't even have to have children. I mean, children kind of helps the process because it's so intense. But they say, well, how do you learn how to do voir dire? And I'd say, do you ever talk to people like at the checkout line?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the same thing I tell people all the time.
How are you doing?
Oh, fine. How are you? Like, that's what we do. Like, seriously, I will talk to people. I'll say, how are you doing? I will look them in the eye. I mean, I don't change my words. I had this one woman say, you know, my son just killed himself, but I don't want to stay at home alone. So I really enjoy coming to this drugstore to work every day because at least I could see, you know. And sometimes you just want them to stop talking to you it doesn't take much to get people to connect. You just really have, it's not just the words you use. It's looking at them and valuing them and kind of just making that mind meld like Spock, you know, like, I want to know. I really care.
So how are you, what are some techniques that you can give our listeners when you're picking a jury, when you're developing that relationship early on, you don't want to like scare them too much, right? Like what do you go about when you have that conversation with the jurors?
Just like I'm doing now. It is, you know, one of my girlfriends calls it cocktail hour chit chat. I don't do cocktail hours as much, but it's literally just caring and talking to people. So when I've had mistrials before because I got all the jurors off for cause, right?
God, I would love your judge.
Yeah. Well, like, she tried to rehabilitate all of them, but she couldn't. They said, no, we are going to not follow your instructions.
Wow.
One after the other. And the judge was very upset that one trial. But basically, I get them to invite themselves off the jury.
Yes. Thank you.
I don't push them off. I don't force them off because I don't want to send that message to the other jurors that I'm just such a wicked, mean person. But if you're able to connect with them and talk about what's important, which is for jurors like that, right, it's like, do you have strong convictions? Yes. do you believe in standing up for your convictions? Yes. If someone told you to put aside your convictions and do what you felt was morally wrong, would you do that? Absolutely
so
not.
So you use the word convictions. Is that intentional?
Everything's intentional.
Yeah. Because I've heard, not that one specifically, but people don't say, well, bias, right? Because everyone's going to say,
I'm biased.
Yeah, everybody would say that. But conviction's a different word.
If you are morally convicted, if you have have absolute certainty that you are right, will you be willing to put that aside because the judge asks you to? No.
Thank God we're recording this because I'm stealing that verbatim.
It's like they just walk off. They want, like, it's a general damages one, right? How strong, you want to talk about, like, oh, yeah, there's too many lawsuits or whatever, and I just cannot. I think all damages should be capped. Can you put that aside?
So educate our listeners. In the state of Washington, are there any caps on damages, anything that you can do that's wildly inappropriate?
I live in the country of the state of Washington where there are no caps on damages. Woo! Thank you very much.
God bless. God bless. Let's keep it that way. It'd be unconstitutional to actually have caps, but, that's a story for a different time.
Yes.
So let me ask you something. We're going to pivot a little bit. How did you ever... You've been referred to as the term avatar before. What is that about?
So the avatar thing came... I suggested that because the bailiff in the Ducks case came to see me afterwards. After it was done, the appeal had been dropped, the claims had been paid. He came to see me, and he wanted to just kind of debrief. It had been such an intense trial for so long, so he wanted to talk about it. And he had kind of these examples of how he saw all the different lawyers, and there were a lot of lawyers. There were like 20 defense lawyers and then two of us, right?
Great optics.
Yeah, great optics. And Artemis, again, said it was so important to be consistent. So initially I was going to have all my co-counsel do each of their plaintiffs, but, they heard me do voir dire and saw the connection that I had built. They saw me do opening, saw that connection just solidify. And so they all voted to just have me do all the plaintiffs.
Wow.
Yeah.
Plaintiffs direct is one of the hardest pieces of trial.
That's a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
And my favorite topic.
Wow.
Yeah. So I did
all
the
part D. Yes,
we had some plaintiffs that all they did was come up and they could barely say anything and they just cried.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's enough.
And I was going to say that's all you need. I've got a case right now where the plaintiff cannot testify.
Yeah.
And you have to let the story unravel.
Yeah. And when I cry, I don't see it out of self-pity. The crying almost always universally came when they were talking about someone else.
Wow.
So you got to, know your clients and what they can do, but his kind of...
But you have to learn 40 stories.
I did. But he felt that my defining characteristic was avatar. He just said, and he just felt like through me, my clients' cases were presented, and that I was their avatar, each one, all 43. So he saw me being, and that's, I think, the difference. Is like, I think I am normally the avatar for each client, but in a case with that many different personalities and languages, half of them had interpreters from different countries. Because this was a foreign international school bus hit by a tourist vehicle.
Wow.
So seeing how you do that, I think, really resonated with him of the avatar, and I thought that is a really great way of looking at what we do as plaintiff lawyers.
I never thought about it that way, but I always like to say we're conduits for the truth.
Me too.
I do a lot of cases in front of engineers. They love that one.
Yes. Right?
Conduits for the truth.
Yes. I used to call it channeling. Like, you guys are way too young, but there used to be some famous people. They went to this kind of guru lady, and she believed she used to talk to Ramtha, which is some kind of ancient god. She could channel Ramtha through
Is this herself. A 900 number that you can dial?
I'm serious. This truly happened.
Call Cleo.
Again, before you were born. So I used to look at it as Ramtha, like it was a channeling, like we're channeling. But the avatar, I think, is good, especially because I think I heard that they're making 3 more episodes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
James Cameron, I heard he was doing something down by us. I'm like, Playa Vista or something. I don't know. Whatever.
Avatar is back.
Avatar 2.
Yep.
Featuring you.
I love it. Blue and big. That's me.
So I have to ask you, is Nelly really a sucker for cornrows and manicured toes?
So the Nelly case, yeah. I got. So, by the way, I have one bad review on Google by a Nelly fan.
Ooh.
Yeah.
They're Nelly fans?
I guess.
Come on, man. Tom's wearing his Air Force Ones for the people watching here. He's from the Lou, and he's proud. Actually, one of our attorneys who was on the podcast before, he's from the Lou. He's not really proud, though.
Well, I saw I'm trying to get his deposition set, but I did. We did on the first case I had. He was at the mediation, and every time I came walking down the hall, his people would hustle him back into the room and shut the door. So I never got to say, hi.
Well, they
I've erased all of your tunes from my iTunes, but
They heard you were the Velvet Hammer. They got a little scared.
They got scared.
Don't let her talk to him. Don't look at him. She's gonna avatar him. So I just want to know from a lifestyle standpoint. You're in trial for 4 or 5 months.
Uh-huh.
You're doing lead on everything, taking 43 plaintiff stories and telling them. How do you find that life-work balance during that time?
I just asked that before we started.
Yeah, so...
it's the end of the first case we tried together. She just had a newborn, and we were just, let's go.
Whoever came up with the word, or that term, life-work balance. Now, the balance is the part that's interesting, because people kind of see that as being like...
even. It's not like...
and not wavering.
Yeah.
But in fact, there is no such thing.
You ever see a seesaw? It doesn't just sit there.
Right. Every day is different. Every day, I'm old now. My children are old, but put it this way.
Spring chicken.
I was writing the trial brief.
I was going to say duckling, but that wasn't.
I was working on the trial brief, and my eldest daughter went into labor. First. So I'd have to go across the bridge to get the hospital. One of my other daughters flew in. So I picked up my daughter from the airport. We drove to the hospital. We were there. My other third daughter came. We're sitting there. My son-in-law's there with my daughter, and nothing's going on. So she decides she wants Chick-fil-A. I leave to go back and work on the trial brief.
Wow.
And my other daughters go get her Chick-fil-A.
Wasn't a Sunday then.
No, not a Sunday. She comes back. I start getting text messages like something's wrong or she's dying. And then they say, you better get back here fast. We think she's going to have... I'm on the bridge when she has my grandchild, her baby, because I had to write a trial brief. But they wouldn't have let me in anyway. I get there, the baby's born. Okay, this baby was born 2 weeks before the trial. When the trial ended, the baby came with
my
daughters and the son. The baby was 4.5 months old.
Oh, my God.
And listen to the entire closing argument.
That's phenomenal.
So my answer is, live an integrated, a fully integrated life as much as you can. Make sure that everything is connected as much as it can. My children are part. They used to come to all my conventions. They knew lawyers when they were little. They didn't play house. They played office.
I love that. I saw it on your website, and my wife was reading it to me because she gets inspired through these things. She's not a lawyer. She's like, this woman's amazing. I'm like, yeah. We actually adopted our daughter out of the state of Washington in Bremerton.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome.
We spent many wonderful weeks there with her before she got adopted. So very cool.
Yeah. So you got to integrate them. You can't have separate lives. Yeah. You got to.
And they've been inspired by you.
Yeah, but none of them will be a lawyer because they said I work too much.
But were you able to take some time? Well, I mean, for a lot of our listeners that practice by themselves or have a small firm, 4 months away from you're away from the office. So let's be honest, you can't do anything else but that trial. Yeah. How do you keep your firm and your other cases going?
But I did keep other cases going.
How?
Well, so I have wonderful staff.
Okay.
I have the paralegal that came with me to trial only did trial, but I had two other paralegals that were working because I've still had cases going.
I mean, do you have any partners?
I have partners, but we do team work on a lot of the cases. So everyone kept everything going. I never file like unavailability statements. Everything keeps going.
Good.
Yeah. So it all keeps going.
See defense attorneys.
I like them.
We're constantly opposing motions to continue trials. Like, what are you guys talking about?
No. We keep going. But it was, I've never done anything like that before. It was very intense. And so some of the associates that we had two that would be helping by getting, I'm not going to even bore with you with all the deals, but we did this trial paperless. I would just go with my computer. No paper. We had over 400 exhibits. We had 271 pages of exhibits, but we didn't use them all.
Oh, that's wonderful.
If you were looking at them, I mean, it was extremely intense, and all of the, and the exhibits were from vehicles all the way down.
Let me ask.
The bottom line is, other people did stuff for me, and so I worked with a lot of solo lawyers, but they paired with me, and
that's
so
good.
That's what the trial lawyer groups.
Well, how
do.
Did you how did you come to be 43 plaintiffs?
Right.
You obviously didn't sign all of them up from the beginning.
I signed up one. I was in trial.
Well, how did you come to be the one that like, all right, Karen, you're going to try this case? How did that come to be?
So the one client hired me when I was in trial on a different case. I immediately did research, because it was a lot of it's public record, and filed a very good complaint. Very, very good. That garnered media attention.
So you were you the first one to file?
No. Hmm. I was like, but they were filing in the wrong jurisdiction, and I didn't like the cases, and some of them weren't right. So I filed a great complaint, and then the other lawyers just started calling me. They all know me. I was trial lawyer president, and then AAJ. So they were calling me, can we join? I'm like, yes. And then other people would just ask me. So by the end of the day, we had almost 50.
Wow. So, I mean, you're essentially, trying 50 cases at once with a product.
Yes. Well, that's
and against a government entity.
Right. And remember, Artemis wanted me to, you know, us to be consistent. And she's the one that said, one plaintiff a day. Tell one plaintiff story a day, no matter what you are in the trial. So it was completely mixed. There was not liability first, and then damages. It was a completely integrated trial.
Yeah, that's almost a way to keep it going, though, to keep it interesting, because if you have 50 plaintiffs, right, or approximately 50 plaintiffs over a four-month period, the jurors have something to get angry about every single day, and they get a new story. And it's kind of like binge watching a good show.
I was just going to say that on Netflix.
Yeah. Like I always get into old stuff later. Like I'm watching Boardwalk Empire now, and it's like I can't stop watching it.
I have never seen Boardwalk Empire. I got to get into it.
It's so good. But
we started watching Cheers. We watched four episodes of Cheers last night.
I was late to Breaking Bad too. So
I actually watched
it. Me too.
Oh God, that's so crazy. But same way, keep them interested. Every episode, something new.
Right.
Every day, something new. Well, I got to ask you though, when you did. This is what's fascinating to me, because anybody that tries Prada cases, and all of us here have, they're difficult. They're expensive. They're nuanced. They're mechanical. You put the lion's share of responsibility on the product. First, for our listeners, how expensive it is to do a case like that, because everybody's got to know. Second, how did you simplify the story for that jury on a Prada case?
I wear a captain's hat and quack.
Quack, quack, quack.
The whole case cost us several million dollars to fund.
Wow.
The single biggest charge was of our forensic psychologist.
Hmm.
And the reason is because I didn't want to have multiple experts. I wanted one for each element, which was a huge bonus. Like the defense had four or five, and it was they would have different methodologies that made them. So I had one psychologist. His bill was over $600,000.
Wow!
And the jury didn't blink. They were trying to shame him for it, but I put it all together, did the math. I was like, yeah, it's over $600,000. What are you gonna do about it? so a very expensive trial to do.
Wow!
The importance of that is that they were offering around $15,000 to $20,000 for the. Half the cases only had psychological damage with a couple bruises or scrapes. They're offering about $15,000 to $20,000, and the jury offer. The jury verdicts were averaged $500,000 for each of those.
Wow. So how were you able to? I mean, we're gonna pivot. There's so much cool shit to talk. I mean,
there is a lot.
I want to talk to you about like, how do you get that much compensation for somebody that just has an emotional injury tied to an event with no physical injury?
Because it wasn't just an emotional injury. Mm-hmm. And we knew from our focus groups that the big cases would bring up the value mm-hmm. of the claim, and the little cases would make the bigger cases bigger. So the big cases made the little cases bigger, and the little cases made the bigger cases bigger. There was a synergy in there, and that's exactly what happened.
So, and Sienna, you just tried a case with another. There were two plaintiffs. You represented one plaintiff with Grayson Goody, and there was another plaintiff that wasn't hurt nearly as bad.
Not at all. She had like $10,000 in medical damages, and I think they were willing to settle for a little bit over that, and she got $100,000 at the end.
Yeah, and Did you find the same thing, that that person's damages were brought up because you were able to recover multiple millions for your client?
Absolutely. And she even, like, she wanted us to represent her, and she's like, you guys are awesome. We worked well together, but I think we got two bites of the apple, like you said earlier. Like, we would direct or cross-examine whoever, and then the co-plaintiff would do the same thing. So we would help each other out.
And I don't think people do that enough, is realize who their allies are in actual trial, right? I mean, the government entities, mm-hmm. they could help you on liability, all kind of cool
awesome.
Stuff.
Well, and the Ducks went against each other. So I had different friends at different
Wait,
times.
Were these the Mighty Ducks? No.
Yeah, these were not so mighty. But they
no
would,
knuckle
yeah,
pucks?
They were helping me but go after each other. It was you just pick your sides constantly.
Wow, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. Well, we're nearing the end of our time, but I mean, I think we went over time, but it's cool.
Oops,
we've had so much good stuff to talk about.
Part two, I want to hear about your plaintiffs direct.
Yeah, so I mean, we will do that. I want to do a second episode because I find one of the hardest, most challenging things to do. Well, I do think jury selection is number one. I think people have to be comfortable in their own skin to do it. But plaintiff directs, a lot of cases are won or lost there, and if you don't do it right, it could be bad. But Karen, thank
whisper.
You. We call Tom the plaintiff whisperer. RX Paris and Rob Paris just walking by the booth. These guys are rock stars, so we're going to try to get them on the show in the near future.
The 100 million club.
Well, this is great.
The Paris brothers, ladies and gentlemen, just walked by. We heard an applause. That's very good. But we have one of the most famous trial lawyers in the country who's tried some just monumental cases. Anybody that's been away from their office and family for multiple weeks, let alone months, it's a tribute to the person that you are, and to inspire others. And just for kicking ass.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for kicking ass and being a cool human being. I think a lot of people get too caught up in the rigmarole of, I got to look and play the part of a lawyer. I got to do this. And you're not that person.
Am I supposed to be complimented by that?
Yes. We don't want to wear stuffy suits.
I mean, I'm wearing sandals and Lululemon. And I just gave a speech in them.
See, that's the
irony. You're real and connecting with people, and now you're dubbed the Avatar.
And the helmet hammer. Trademark.
I mean, I do. I'm a Lululemon guy. 50% of the week.
I'm telling
lie.
You, Lulu is all. It's all about the Lulu. But
and I'm all about the lining in the gym shorts. Don't care. Yeah, that's what I am. That's me. That's who I am. So
thank you guys so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Thank you for coming on. If you guys ever have a case in the state of Washington or anywhere else, call the Velvet Hammer, because she'll kill you with kindness, but she will F you up for real, bro. So any questions, bd@justiceteam.com. Please check out her website. Talk to her. She's just a cool human being. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in for this episode of the Justice Team Podcast. And Sienna, what do we have to tell our listeners?
Contact us at mediajustice.com and follow us on Justice Team Podcast. What?
And no.
No sleep till justice.
We're going to roll out with Real Big Fish by Grayson Goody.
Well, I know you don't want to be injured all your life, but don't settle that case tonight. I said it's not too late. And I don't remember what I read. Don't remember what they said. I guess it doesn't matter. I guess it doesn't matter anymore. You're gonna go to the expert store. You're gonna give them all your money. They'll tell the jury what it wants to hear. They tell me it's cool, but I just don't believe it. Tell